gigahertz, 5 gigahertz basic rates, channel bonding, supported rates, interference, SSIDs, security, and controller and infrastructure. These are the 10 items that pose the biggest problems in networks not being optimized. So they're not necessarily a problem per se. You may not see any indicators that these issues exist, but they may be affecting your performance. So we start here with the band usage. So the purpose of this one is to see, are we using both the 2.4 and the 5 gigahertz band under the best circumstances? So the first question is, are business critical applications limited to 5 gigahertz band with unique SSIDs? And one of the reasons why we do this is that, number one, the business critical or primary applications are any applications that are important to your operations. If they slow down, fail, you're going to have some trouble. Using the 5 gigahertz for these is best because it provides better performance. It has more channels available, better data rates available, and fewer interference sources. Use of the 2.4 gigahertz band for these applications isn't advised or recommended, but sometimes you have to because some of your devices may not be 5 gigahertz capable. They're only 2.4. So we answer these questions as a yes, no, and a. In this case, let's say you didn't. So what it's going to ask me is it justified? So I can say yes or no. It's justified if you have devices that can't use the 5 gigahertz, but it's not if you don't, and that causes a failure. The next item on the list is our best effort guest and IoT applications limited to the 2.4. And we do this because these applications aren't important to our operations. They're just there so that people have some kind of access to the network. But it's not important to the operation. So putting those on the 2.4 frees up airspace to allow those important applications to not have to compete with them. So leaving them on there is a good idea. So again, there is a possibility that you may have to, but it's preferred that you not. And then the last item on this list is, are any SSIDs shared across 2.4 and 5 gigahertz band? This is not recommended. And simply because what happens is, with devices that are dual band capable, if you enable them the same SSID on both 2.4 and 5, because 2.4 propagates better and the algorithms built into your client devices, in a lot of cases, they will tend to favor the 2.4 gigahertz band and not allow them to perform optimally. So the best idea is to make sure that if you have to use both, put unique SSIDs on each band. So add a suffix to it. Just the regular one, let's say it's BYOD. So your first 2.4 gigahertz SSID is just BYOD, but on the 5 gigahertz, it might be BYOD best. Something that causes people to go ahead and use the better band. It's kind of a mental thing. They see that word best, and they're going to navigate to it. So in this case, we failed two items. Our overall score is only a 0.4, and you can see up here it shows us you did pass some, but not everything. It's not a complete failure. The second item on the list is the 2.4 gigahertz, using only channels 1, 6, and 11. And we do that because, as most people know, 1, 6, and 11 are the only non-overlapping channels. In 802.11, there is a mechanism to allow devices to coexist on the same channel. Off channels, channels 2 through 5 and 7 through 10, are what we call adjacent channel interference to these three channels. The problem is 802.11 does not have a mechanism to deal with adjacent channel interference, only to deal with co-channel interference. So using those other channels is not a good idea. So in this case, answering no would be a pass. The next item on our list is the 5 gigahertz channels. We want to use all the channels that are supported by the client devices. And the reason is there's a total of 25 channels available in the 5 gigahertz band. Now, some you may not want to use, others you do, but you want to use as many as you can because that reduces the channel reuse. So we start out with the Uni One channels. That's channels 36 through 48. They're compatible with most devices, although I have run across a couple, they're not. And they're non-DFS. Radios are not required to automatically change channels if they detect something else on the same band. But it is important that you verify them as client compatible. The next item on the list, Uni 2A channels, that's channels 52 through 64. These are not compatible with all devices, so it is important that you verify. And as far as verification goes, there's a couple different ways to do it. There are some sites out there that'll show you exactly what channels they're capable of. The manufacturer's website is one of them. There's some third-party sites that list them. Or you can simply put an AP, a test AP, with a special SSID on that particular channel, and just open up your device and see if it sees that SSID. If it does, then it should be available. Now, one thing to keep in mind with Uni 2A is there are a few devices out there that are not compatible with channels 52 and 56. They only start at channel 60 on up. But again, make sure you verify that they're compatible with your devices. Uni 2C channels, that's channels 100 through 144. These channels do have some special circumstances. They are DFS. Channels 120, 124, and 128 use the same frequencies as airport terminal Doppler weather radar. And so there, if you're near an airport or you're a hospital with a helipad that has this system in place, you may not want to use those particular channels. And then the last one in this band, channel 144, that one wasn't authorized for use until 2014. And so devices built before that may not be compatible with that particular channel. So again, you need to verify that these are compatible. The next one on the list is Uni 3 channels. These are channel 149 through 165. Most devices are compatible with these. However, there are some circumstances where you might not want to use them. If you've got Apple TVs, Gen 4 Apple TVs use all channel 149 through 161. Earlier Apple TVs will use channels 149 and 153. So there may be some interference from those, but you should verify they're compatible. And if your environment allows them for use, go ahead and use them. DFS channel change events occurred regularly on Uni 2A or 2C. So we need to look at that. It doesn't mean you can't use those bands if they have. It may only involve one or two channels, and you simply need to eliminate those from use. Now, if you answer yes, then that's something you need to take a look at. If you're not using these, then again, as mentioned before, you may want to consider it. If Uni 2C channels 120, 124, 128 are in use, has client station compatibility been verified? This is important. Again, just like I talked about with the band itself, a lot of manufacturers, in order to avoid issues, just made those channels unavailable to their devices through the firmware. And then those other two channels I talked about, channel 5 on 5 gigahertz, channels 144 and 165, you need to verify those are compatible. 165 was not authorized for use until 2010. So again, there may be some devices out there that can't see those. So if you meet all these, as you can see, we've got a partial success here. We just go back and look at the failures and see what we can do to fix those. The next item on the list is basic rates. So basic rates are important because these are going to determine how reliable and fast our systems are going to, our devices are going to perform. A low connection rate means they're going to slow down. And keep in mind that those rates aren't static. Just because I can stand in one place and see a signal strength that gives me, let's say, a 24 megabit speed, doesn't mean if I move 10 feet to my right that it's not going to drop down to 5. So you need to look overall the entire environment, because out at the fringe of an AP's coverage, this does get reduced. Secondly, it'll get reduced if you have multiple clients. As every client joins and starts using the network, the speed they're going to be able to see is going to be reduced. So you may have to bump up your enabled data rates to allow for this, but it's important that you use in the 2.4, 6, 12, or 24 only. And the reason for that is because these three data rates are required to be supported by all devices under 802.11, whereas any other data rate doesn't have to be supported. So if you were to enable, say, 18 megabits, there may be a device that you have that can't connect at that speed and therefore won't get on the network. So then we do the same thing in the 5 gigahertz band. And again, the reasons are the same. These data rates are more robust than the rest, as well as being required by the 802.11 standard. Oops, sorry. And to make that a pass. So now we have to look at a few other items. Is 6 megabits eliminated from the 5 gigahertz basic rate set? And the reason why you do that is if you want clients to be connected at higher speeds, then you need to start disabling some of the lower ones. And basic rate sets, of course, are the ones that clients are required to be able to maintain in order to be connected. So if we reduce these rates, we may allow clients to roam more efficiently, but also operate in a more optimal fashion. So in this case, it's always going to ask me, is it justified? So in this case, I'm going to say yes, because we realize that 6 megabits is not going to give us the performance we're looking for. And then we ask ourselves the same question of 12 megabits. Remember, there's only three here, 6, 12, and 24. So these are the ones you're going to eliminate. 24 should never be eliminated from this, because it is the highest speed. It's going to be the one that, if we have multicast traffic, that's going to go at that rate, if at the very least. So is 12 megabits? Again, we're only going to eliminate that if we need faster speeds for our devices and applications to perform optimally. So again, no matter which way you answer this one, it's going to ask whether it's justified or not. So it's only justified if I decide that this is the lowest speed I want to maintain. So next one on our list is channel bonding. And of course, channel bonding is not always recommended. A lot of people get into this idea that, oh, there's faster speeds if I bond the channels, but there's also fewer channels. So as we go through these, I'll point out, but you need to decide, what do I really need? So just as I noted before with the basic rates, the same thing applies with the channel bonding. You need to make sure you're using the right configuration that gives you the most optimal performance. If you need 40 megahertz or 80 megahertz, that's fine. But you have to need it, not just want it. So the first one is, are 40 megahertz channels in use on the 2.4 gigahertz band? This, of course, is part of the 802.11. It's not recommended. Under any circumstances, there's not enough channels there. It's just not worth doing. You're going to create a whole lot of headaches for nothing. Now the 5 gigahertz, we have to start looking at, and again, in this case, in the case of all the 5 gigahertz bonding, we have to determine, is it actually justified? Just because we did it doesn't mean it's good. So if I only need 20 megahertz channels, and I've been to a lot of places where 20 megahertz channels gives them more than enough speed to do what they have to do. You get into a warehouse where all they're doing is using hand scanners. The biggest packet I've ever seen come across the network was 125K. So I don't need 300 megabit speed. It's not going to make that much of a difference. I can live with 12 megabit or 24 megabit. So in this case, no matter how I answer it, it's going to ask me whether or not it's justified. 80 megahertz, now we get into a bigger issue. So with the 40 megahertz bonding, we're decreasing our channels to a total of 12. With 80 megahertz, we're reducing that further to where we only have 6 channels. So we don't want to use it unless it's necessary. So we look at that and decide, do we need the speeds that are offered, the data rates that are offered by using 80 megahertz channels? If we can get those same speeds, because remember, in a lot of cases, the speeds available in one bonding at certain levels are also available on the level below it. So we just need to make sure we bond channels if needed to get us to the right data rates. So in this case, I'm going to say, no, they're not in use. And then the last one is 160 megahertz channels. This one, you're talking 2 channels total if you use this. So using this, you have to really need it, because you're talking, as far as co-channel interference developing, it's worse than 2.4 gigahertz with only 2 channels, because every other AP is going to be on the same channel. So if you can't separate those, co-channel interference is going to be a major issue. Now, we do have to keep in mind that 80 megahertz and 160 are only available in 802.11ac, and they do use RTS-CTS, which is request to send, clear to send, on all channels bonded, and only utilize the width that comes back as clear to send. So if it sends out 4 messages, request to send on 4 different channels, and let's say it's channels 52 through 64, and only 52 and 56 come back with yes, then your device is actually going to switch to 40 megahertz in order to do its transmission. It's not going to use all 4 channels. Same thing with 160 megahertz, but we're talking 8 channels that it's going to do that RTS-CTS. So we're better off not using 160 megahertz unless there's really a need for it. And at present, I don't see it. Now, I'm not sure, but Rick may discuss some of the changes that are coming up that might make this actually doable. So the next one is supported rates. So we need to base our target RSSI and SNR levels on client application requirements. Too many people get locked into this, I need a minimum signal strength of this. Well, minimum signal strength doesn't necessarily give you what you're looking for. What you're looking for are data rates. So we have to make sure that we've got a signal strength, a signal to noise ratio that allows the data rate to work. If I get too bad, if this SNR gets too low, even though I've got a network that could theoretically support 477 megabits, I may only be able to achieve 100. If I need 200 minimum, then I'm going to see some problems. So first thing we have to do is identify the requirements. If we haven't identified those requirements, it's a failure. Because without knowing the requirements, you don't know whether or not your network is configured appropriately. And then we have to look at, do the targets actually meet the requirements we identified? So if we say we need 200 megabits minimum, we have to make sure that RSSI and SNR target actually meets that requirement. It will allow our devices to do what we need them to do. Those are the only 2 items in there. If you get these 2 right, you could have a very well-run network. If you miss on those, maybe not. So the seventh item here is interference. And this is actually one of the most common things that we see. First off is the 2.4 gigahertz band. Is there co-channel interference present in the 2.4 gigahertz band? If there is, then we've got a couple choices. Either A, live with it. B, turn down the power so they're not interfering with each other. And the general rule of thumb is when it comes to coverage levels, the desired signal strength should be achieved at 60% of the distance to the neighboring AP. If we look at a heat map of the coverage area, that's what we're looking for. If it is present, the third option is turn some of them off. If we don't need that many, and of course, quantities of APs are determined based on how many clients are going to be using them, we set a limit as to the maximum number of people that can associate to an AP. So we're going to look at that. Maybe we can afford to turn off half the radios. And of course, the second one is co-channel present in the 5 gigahertz band. This is very common when you start bonding channels together. This can be reduced by power levels or a more optimal channel reuse plan. One of the things we do see is with some controllers, they have a tendency to favor channels. I've actually been on surveys where there's 100 APs present and 40 of them are on channel 36, and then it's maybe 9 or 10 in any of the other channels. And then some channels go completely unused. So we need to look at that to see if that's something that we need to fix. So co-channel interference is very common. I see it all the time. It's also, we'll get into this in a later section, but it's also due to the power level settings. If you leave, use Cisco's RRM or Aruba's ARM, you're letting the controller automatically adjust the power in any of the manufacturers. Sometimes it doesn't quite do it right. So we have to pay attention to that. We have to look and see what do we need to do to fix that. The next one, SSIDs. So we have to limit the number of SSIDs per radio and justify the use of any hidden SSIDs. So here are more than three or four unique SSIDs in use on the 2.4 gigahertz radios. Now, this does not mean do you have more than three or four SSIDs set up. If you have areas where area one is using, let's say you have six SSIDs, area one's using three of them, and area two's using four of them, area three's only using two of them, that's okay. As long as the APs aren't broadcasting too many APs or too many SSIDs out of any given radio. So whether you realize it or not, hidden or broadcast, they're going to beacon. It doesn't matter which. If you look at actual packet captures, a hidden network still has a beacon. It just doesn't contain the SSID name. The downside to hiding SSIDs is people have to look for them. In the 2.4 or 5 gigahertz band, which is our next one here, either one of them, the only reason I'm aware of that you could even remotely justify using a hidden SSID is if they're used by devices that never move. So they never have to roam. They'll never have to probe for the network. Once they're connected, they'll just stay connected. But if you don't absolutely have to, excuse me, there's not a good reason to do it. So in this case, we want to answer no to pass this in both cases. Oops, missed it. So just go over that and look at it. Also keep in mind that as far as most controllers go, 16 SSIDs is the absolute limit. Once you go beyond that, for several of the manufacturers, it's repeating virtual MAC addresses that it uses for them. So keep them to a minimum. There's only a few reasons to create an SSID. Number one, you're segmenting your network and they have different VLANs. Number two, they're being used by devices that have different security capabilities. Okay, and number three is they're for special use. They're for devices that, again, if you're hiding it or whatever, they're for devices that are better off using a different SSID. But if you're, it's not accessing a different segment of the network, there's very little reason to do that. So again, the last one is hidden SSIDs in use. And as I said before, hiding an SSID does not provide any additional security. There are at least 100 free tools out there on the internet that I can get that will discover that. All I need is somebody to use it, and their packets contain the name of the SSID. So I can discover it no matter what. So hiding it just, it doesn't really provide any security. Hiding it does in some cases. Unfortunately, we've all experienced the user who just clicks on something trying to connect and calls you up, says, "Well, I can't get connected." And it's because they're trying to connect to the wrong SSID. Okay, so remember, SSIDs, if necessary, otherwise, don't just arbitrarily create them. Security is our next item, and we want to avoid the use of TKIP, WEP, or none as encryption methods because these provide either little security or they have limitations for the devices using them. So the first one is AES CCMP encryption used on all basic service sets. We want that to be the case. This is the strongest. It's not been broken. Maximum security for network. And unless devices aren't compatible with this, there's no reason not to use it. And the truth is, if you have devices that aren't compatible with this, you might want to do an upgrade because they'd have to be pretty old to not be compatible. TKIP encryption, is it in use? One of the things, this is part of 802.11n. So devices using that are using TKIP, they are going to be limited to 54 megabits, no faster. Now, if you have these devices present, any device on your network that needs to use it, you'll have to do it. But keep in mind that the devices that are using this, all the other devices may get slowed down while this thing's transmitting. So they'll get delayed. You might see slower performance, and only use it if it's required. So is WEP or none types of encryption used on any basic service sets? We do not recommend this. There's no security for this. It doesn't help you. It can be exploited. So it's just not recommended for use. Pre-shared key or 802.11x. So that's pre-shared key, of course, is WPA, PA2 personal. 802.1x would be WPA, WPA2 enterprise. Roaming can be impacted by using these. Because of the authentication. So it should be augmented with 802.11r. So we're going to look at that. Is it used? And if so, do we have the best roaming configuration set up? So providing these levels of security and avoiding the non-security and slow performing encryptions is going to help you improve your network performance. So keep these in mind when you're doing this. So last one is the controller and infrastructure. This first one is the most common item I see. As I mentioned before, AP power levels configured at or below lowest capable client device. Every manufacturer by default has these levels set up to where they're blasting away in effect. Cisco, it's a minimum power of minus 10, maximum power of 30 dBm. In the case of Aerohive, it's 2 to 23. Devices that we have are not as strong as the APs. Most APs can do anywhere from 100 milliwatts of power to a watt of power. That's their capability. However, most of your devices you're using, they tend to be what I would call consumer-grade devices, your Dell laptops, anything that's not something like a Toughbook. Toughbooks are commercial-grade devices and have more powerful radios in them. They're not able to achieve power rates generally above 17 or 18, so I would prefer to set this, if that's all I've got, at a 15 maximum, just because I want to give the client device a little wiggle room, because it depends on where a signal is started. It may have to go through obstructions sooner than the AP signal coming to them does, and may have a bigger effect on it. So we want to give them just that little bit of extra power. So if we've done that, if we've set that so that we can't get, and this is known as either a near-far issue or power symmetry issue, where my device can hear the AP, but the AP can't hear me because I lack the power to get back to it. As long as you avoid those, you should have a good performance on your network. So next one is our channels bonding in one direction only. And I see this a lot. When you're using auto channeling and you're using channel bonding, sometimes a controller will bond, let's say channel 36 is a primary bonded with channel 40. And then there's another AP in the same network that's using channel 40 as a primary and channel 36 as a secondary. So by doing this, when some of these devices do their clear channel assessment, determine whether or not they're able to transmit, they may find their primary frequency is free and clear, but the secondary doesn't. Now, of course, again, that's only applicable to up to 802.11n. The next item is the controller, AP controller manager on the latest stable firmware. And this is important to look at because the later firmwares will provide additional features that you may not have had before. Now, when we say the latest stable firmware, we're not talking about what the manufacturer considers as its latest stable firmware. It's the level of firmware that's stable for your network. So if you have, let's say, a mix of APs, some old, some new, they may only be able to go up to, let's say, version 8.5, whereas the newest model of AP you have can go up to 8.7. Well, by putting in 8.7, you just lost all the older radios that can only do 8.5. The controller can no longer manage them. So you have to look at that. Is it the right one, compatible with everything I have? It's not going to cause anything to cease to function and will give me features I didn't have before. Are APs and antennas properly mounted? I see this quite a bit. If they're not properly mounted, they could be close to, I've seen some schools where the AP is sitting right just behind and above a projector. Well, that projector could be causing shadowing, or it's right next to a column where the column can cause shadowing. They need to be at least 3 to 4 feet clear of any obstruction or reflector distorter. So even your fluorescent lights, they have reflectors in them that can bounce the signal and prevent it from being heard properly by the AP. So we need to make sure that those things are mounted correctly. The last item on the list, let me get rid of this, are APs on the latest stable firmware. So for the same reason that we look at the controller's firmware, we want to look at the AP's firmware. Are they the latest stable? And there are things that come up from time to time, features, additional, you know, just like in 2010 and 2014, when they added channels 165 and 144 for use by indoor APs. Until you updated your firmware, your radio might not be able to use them. Now, generally speaking, a lot of the radios can do more than what you think they can. They're just limited by their firmware. In other cases, they're not. Firmware isn't going to give you additional channels. But look at that. Make sure they're up to date. And also, they should be the same. So you shouldn't have the same model AP, let's say 10 of them, and six are on the latest and four are on two generations back. That can cause issues with your controller. So overall, we've seen the 10 items that we look at. And you can see your score up here, some partial stars, some full stars, some complete failures. Overall score of 8 out of 10. So what we look for, of course, is a 10. But this is where I did put in the failures. They're not things that can't be fixed. We just have to go in and do some setting changes. In one case here, and here we just have to go in and make sure we understand what the network needs to do in order to perform optimally. So if we do all that, if we look at this score and we take actions on the items that were less than perfect, all you're left with after that is some minor details. And those are, generally speaking, they can be special circumstances that don't exist everywhere, but do in a few places under certain circumstances again. So at this time, that's pretty much it what we look at. Now, obviously, when we look at this, it's not as quick and simple. We have to do controller reviews. We do surveys. We do maybe packet captures, depending on what we need to do. So there may be some additional things to do to determine if any of these are true or false, but this is actually what we're looking for. So this time I'll go ahead and turn it back over.
Thanks, Dave. Excellent. Really, really appreciate that. Hey, Rick, thank you also. Rick's been answering a lot of questions. Keep the questions coming. We really, really appreciate that. Rick, were there any questions that you wanted to kind of call out to the group just as a clarification of anything? And yes, I know Rick, I'm not going to let you go long. I'm glad you looked at your watch. but if you want to kind of point out any questions, answers, that'd be great.
Oh, we got some great, great questions. I was very, very happy with them. I was having fun answering them. I hope it was semi-readable because I don't type that well. But some of them I thought I'd like to share with Dave if we have time. That's why I was looking at the lot. And I just had
we have 15 minutes
addressed yet. So if we're okay with that, let's see, let me open this up. Dave, do you want to, can you open up the questions? And I'm not sure if it shows my answers in line or not. Let me see, answered questions.
Real time high throughput. I see I'm sorry. Here we go. I see four that weren't answered, 15 that you did answer. So we're looking at the four you didn't?
Well, why don't you take a look at the 15 that I did answer. And, you know, I answered from my opinion, and you might want to add your own insight to that. And I'll look at the four at the end and get ahead of you if you want to do that.
Let's see. Okay. Yeah. So obviously, as Rick mentioned, one of the questions was with the problem with sharing 2.4 and 5. On a single SSID still be there if band steering is implemented. It's been our experience that band steering is not 100% effective. It doesn't always work because unfortunately, unlike before where the controller actually was in control, nowadays, because of the newer devices, they're actually in control. There's a whole lot of information contained within an AP's beacon that it evaluates to decide what to connect to. And that doesn't always fall in line with what the controller itself would prefer. So that one, yeah, it doesn't always work. And unfortunately, it's just a shortfall in the algorithm that's used by the client devices. And they don't care whether the controller says to band steer or not.
So Rick, this is Scott, I'll take the next one.
Okay.
Is the digital version of this going to be available? Yes. What we're going to do is we're going to make an online version of this that allow you to grade it and score it. And it will be free to education, government, military, anybody with .org, K-12 email addresses will get free access to it. We do provide this to all of our corporate customers and clients. So, you know, all our clients do get this with their engagements. So, but we will be sending an email out probably on Monday or Tuesday. We're just finishing up the live version of it. So it will be available for education, Jen.
Yeah, and just so since we're on the subject, let me go ahead and share this. This is actually, I've been working on this. There's just a little bit of programming left to it, but this will be posted on our website. Up here, you'll see the X's, stars, your actual score. And here's where you answer yes or no to each of the items. So this will be going up soon. Okay, the next one, Spectrum XT, a viable test instrument, continuous scan radar detection, say 12 hours. XT is a good device to find radar, but unfortunately, because radar typically is sweeping, it's got to be the perfect storm. It has to be scanning the right frequency at the exact moment that a sweep is going by. So it's a good tool, but over 12 hours, I would say, yeah, you probably would see it, but there is no guarantee.
And it's hard. You know, we've done it before. You know, we've had a school that we had it set up for 8 hours, and an event happened, and we could not detect it. So we weren't 100% sure if it was Spectrum, you know, if it was a Spectrum or Spectrum XT, or whether it did not actually happen. Because we do know that we hear people, you know, they're like, look, our controller said that there was a DFS event, but we're really, really not sure that we had one. So it's like Rick said, it's very hard to detect that, but it can capture it, but it's very hard.
Yeah. And then just a point of clarification, I think, when I was talking about terminal Doppler weather radar, that exists on channel 120, 124, and 128. Uh, 11KV scenarios. So mesh networks can be a whole nother ball game. Simply because number one, a mesh network should be limited to outdoor use. Indoors, I've seen people try and use it. It just doesn't work very well because one of the things you may or may not notice is that if you use a discovery tool, you can see the signal strength fluctuating constantly. So it makes it very hard, whereas outdoor mesh, yeah, there might be some stuff going by, but it doesn't fluctuate quite as over quite a range. I've actually seen indoors AP signals vary by as much as 20 dB, whereas outdoors, 5 dB, give or take. So KVNR, those are to help roaming and whatnot. Those should be enabled if they work. Most manufacturers of the devices recommend that. The justification field, somebody was asking about that. There actually is one, but that's in the one we use. For the purposes of the web-based one, that's not. There's actually the scorecard I showed you. There's actually a program I wrote that's part of our reporting system, and based on your answers, it actually comes up with some where the shortfalls are, and you can actually, in that one, you can put in the justification for it. But for purposes of that, we're not planning on saving it. It's not linked to a database or anything. It's just a straight web page so people can do a quick look. So the next one was effective range on 80 megahertz channels. Yes, 80 megahertz, as Rick pointed out to the questioner, 80 megahertz requires four times more power to equal the same area as a 20 megahertz channel. So again, it's not a matter of range. You're gonna, by using those higher bonding rates, you're also possibly gonna increase the number of APs that are required to get your network working right. So don't arbitrarily use any of the bonded channels. Use them because they're needed. You have to get data rates. And I'll give you a good example, although in my opinion, it's not a great example. A hotel that decided they wanted to have the fastest network there ever was, so it was mandatory that they use 80 megahertz, but because of the number of people and the number of APs, trying to achieve that was very difficult. I'm not sure if it's going to be possible, just because when a client associates to one AP and starts walking away from it, if he doesn't roam because that AP signal strength hasn't dropped to its trigger point, and every client device has its own trigger point, then it's not going to bother trying to roam. So whether it's by the signal strength, which for most devices is a neg 70 RSSI, or a data rate where your network is set up to where it says you need to do at least 24 megabits, it's not going to roam, and so that's not always going to work. So you need to be careful with that. If they require the throughput, then yeah, you need to use it, but you need to really be very careful about your design so that you're not overlapping. Because again, with 80 megahertz wide channels, you're talking, if you eliminate the TDWR channels, five channels that are usable.
That's changing.
Yeah. And Rick's will mention that at the very end. We'll be extended, and this is the next question, so I'll leave this one for Rick. Wi-Fi 6E.
Let's see. Did you miss a couple?
Don't think so.
Let's see.
Oh, I'm sorry. Bruce? Yes, I did.
From Bruce?
Yep. I missed from Bruce. Yeah. Do I say recording the video? I kind of, the video conferencing. So devices and applications that require a certain level of throughput, that's going to determine whether or not you need to use a given bonded channel. Checklist is for enterprises. It's for anywhere that you can link those. But yeah, typically because the home network, a lot of those will apply. But in a lot of people's home networks, they've got basically routers and whatnot, wireless routers that are provided by their service provider, and they don't allow them to make any changes to them. But if you can, like myself, my wireless network here at my house is controlled by me. So yeah, I do use a lot of them. Now, some of them you can't. They're not available as settings, but those will apply to anywhere that those settings can be made. So if I can't control channel bonding, for instance, then that doesn't apply. But most of them, like I said, with my network, I can actually choose what to connect it to. Now, in my case, I actually do use on 5 gigahertz, I have an 80 megahertz channel bonding be used because I did a survey of my house and none of my neighbors are using any of the Uni 2 A or C channels. So I've got all those free and clear for me. So there is zero interference. I can use them. There's no channel interference between my APs. So yeah, I mean, if you can get away with it, it's a great way to go. So now we're at the 6E.
Okay. So just yesterday, the Federal Communications Commission authorized unlicensed usage in the 6 gigahertz band, 1,200 megahertz of new spectrum. There's two sets of rules. One is for standard power APs, which can be used indoors or outdoors. One is for indoor only low power APs, but their idea of a low power AP is 18 dBm on a 20 megahertz channel. and up to 30 dBm on a 160 megahertz wide channel. So that is more space, more channels than all of 2.4. It's more than double 2.4 and 5 gigahertz together. So that's the new reality. How long will it take to for that to start emerging? I expect to see SOHO and SMB routers and APs starting to show up from the vendors. Seems like the consumer market is always hit with the early adopter versions first, and I expect to see those start to emerge quickly. The rule went into law yesterday. If you want to read more about it, what the exact specifications are, I know it's a lot of text and a lot of boring detail, but if you just look at my channel plan on FutureFi Chapter 5 on Wireless Training Solutions under blogs, and kind of skim through that to get an idea of what's coming, it's nothing but good news in every way you can imagine. In fact, the biggest issues coming out with Wi-Fi 6E will probably be how do we live with this embarrassing amount of riches that we've just been gathered. Imagine if a client device has to scan all of 2.4, all of 5 gigahertz, and all of 6 gigahertz before it makes a decision on which AP to join or roam to. These are things that we've got to figure out more efficient ways to handle, because you don't want a 1 minute delay while your device is originally getting connected or roaming. So these are some of the fantastic problems that we're going to be having in the very near future, I would say by fall. Yeah. So this is why Scott doesn't let me do most of the talking, because I tend to beat it to death. Sorry about that. Any other questions about Wi-Fi 6E? This is my current favorite topic. That and home networking are the two things I'm working on. So back to you, Dave.
Okay. So, yeah, it's going to be, another, 60 channels that are going to be made available. So
it depends. We got to figure out where we're going to start the first channel. Then it'll either be 59 or 60.
Yep. Yeah. So, that's going to make, and again, as we pointed out in there, as far as using the 5 gigahertz for your primary operations, that's going to make a whole new game. I mean, starting to use bonded channels, it can be done. But again, even with this new bandwidth that's being freed up, we don't recommend bonding channels unless it's required. It just causes issues. Co-channel interference can be present because they're sharing frequencies. So if you don't have to have it, don't use it. Now, maybe you could say go to, with these additional channels, you might be able to go up to 40 megahertz just because you feel like it.
Could I jump in, Dave? I know this is new and this is some thinking mostly on my own. I think there's going to be a whole new design paradigm, and that's going to be, I think we're going to use the 5 gigahertz. That's going to be our advertising and discovery band. And we're going to set up even 160 megahertz channels on APs in 6 gigahertz. But you will discover them on 5 gigahertz, and you can even pre-authenticate all the way up. So you can do probe request, probe response, auth one, auth two, and then you get handed over onto the 6 gigahertz band to do the association request and reply. So
and also keep in mind,
guys, we have 1 minute left, but I think it just sounded like Rick has a good topic for his next webinar.
Yeah. Just keep in mind, one other thing is that channel bonding doesn't have to be used everywhere. Just because maybe you need it in, let's say, a gymnasium or a library or cafeteria, you could still set those up with channel bonding, but everything else is set for 20 megahertz. You don't have to use it everywhere just because you need it somewhere.
And to answer everybody's question, there's going to be a recording of this. We'll post that on Monday, along with the link to get access to the software that Dave's going to have online to access the scorecard. So we'll be pushing that to all the attendees.
And sorry if we missed your question.
Oh, you got a few more really good questions. I'm going to, Scott, I'm not sure how the mechanics, but I would like to answer these questions going
forward. Go for it. Just keep going. If you want to keep, you know, if everybody, we're going to have a recording of this. So if you want to keep going with those questions, go for it, Rick.
Okay. Unless Dave, you want to address them?
No, you go ahead. I'm not sure which ones you're referring to.
So. The open questions. Now there's 12. Okay. You know, if, yeah, so this is officially the end of the hour, and that's all the time we have a right to expect from you. But if you want to hang out some more, Scott, is that okay if we keep the...
That's fine. Absolutely.
Okay. You want to real quick put up your contacts?
Right.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and share that, Rick.
And we can talk over it. So one of the other questions, if Spectrum XT can't detect radar, then how can a client, it's actually not the client that detects it, it's the AP. And almost every AP out there does, believe it or not, have built-in Spectrum capabilities. So it can see that there's something there because it listens to the frequency. That's also part of how in the auto channel, it's part of the information sent back to the controller by the AP that says, this is what my environment looks like. So it can tell on this frequency, I see high energy. But it's also, most spectrum analyzers actually look at patterns to the energy, because certain devices, in fact, in Spectrum XT itself by Air Magnet, it actually looks at those patterns and can identify, this is a microwave, this is a Bluetooth, this is a baby monitor, because their energy patterns are slightly different. Maybe narrower band, maybe, flatter lines, or you look at Bluetooth, it looks like a sawtooth because it's constantly changing the channel it's on, and it's narrow band. So it actually looks in the spectrum analyzers, it looks like a sawtooth pattern. Let's see what else. So most of this stuff, a Cajon Air Magnet retool for 6 gigahertz. That would be my hope. Now, I think the main thing for the tools being retooled, of course, the first thing that has to happen is there's got to be an adapter that could see it. At present, the Ekahau Sidekick or the Proxim adapter preferred by Air Magnet, those ones, you couldn't update the firmware and have them see 6 gigahertz. They'd have to come out with all new cards. I'm not aware of any adapters that are 6 gigahertz capable. The radios may be, if you look at the specs, actually most radios in the newer devices are actually capable of doing both 2.4 and 5. And in fact, that's what's brought around the what they call flexible radio assignment, where some radios, instead of being a dual band, they can be twin 5 gigahertz radios because the radios built into them saw both 2.4 and 5, but I'm not aware of any device out there that's been manufactured, unless it came out this year, that includes the 6 gigahertz capability. So we are going to have to wait some time before that's going to be available. And of course, once all this comes into play, once we have the actual requirements of the use of it, as far as the radios go, the 802.11 part of it, that's going to change how we might design things and place APs. It is going to kind of change the ball game.
Rick, were there any questions you wanted to, that you just addressed?
I was typing like the wind, Scott, not paying attention.
We'll see. I'm going to be on the...
Let's see. And thanks for all the kudos, you guys. Much appreciated. Let's see. There was a couple that I answered.
Yeah, there was one about a section on device types and applications, but that actually is something when we need to do something like that, we look at those and we develop a capacity plan. So we look at how many APs we'll need to give how certain number of devices, the throughput they need, but that kind of goes beyond, and it's actually something that some do it well, some tools that are already out there, and others are missing because obviously it's hard to keep up with everything. It's technology is moving so fast.
Dave, I had a question about the online version of the scorecard, and will anybody who uses that be able to print out a report?
Yes. Yes, it will. You just right click the web page and hit print and it'll print out. The only problem I've had with it is for some strange reason on my printer, at least, it doesn't print the colors. It just prints the lines and the text, but you can actually see it. And when I say colors, I mean the background colors. It does print the stars and X's as appropriate, but I'm working on that to get that printable. It
shows the different star coloring degrees, right?
Yes. Yes, it does print those out. But like I said, you see at the top of it was that dark gray band that said network and implementation scorecard. That dark gray background doesn't print, but the text changes to black so you can actually see it.
Okay. Scott, I think that's all. Most of the other notes were just some very nice questions and kudos. Thank you to everybody.
So, Rick, do you want to put up that last slide, just our contact information, then I'll kind of sign us off here. Everybody, we really appreciate you coming out. Sorry about the snafu yesterday, but I think it was definitely worth it. Great job, Dave and Rick. Really appreciate it. And that's all for now, but stay tuned. We'll send you a link and let you know where you can get the recording. All right? Thanks, everybody. You guys have a great weekend. Thanks. Be safe out there.
All right.
Bye.